pleasure to share with you some of the things that I've been working on throughout my PhD at Stanford. So this is our car, Shelley, and what I'd like to talk about is how the research that we do of racing around a racetrack can improve the safety of folks on the road in autonomous cars someday. First of all, I imagine many of you know that traffic accidents today is a very big cost, as well economic cost, as well as crashes are quite large. In fact, this particular photo that you see here is not something that I've just searched on the internet and found. This is actually my grandmother's car only a month ago. Now, luckily, she was not hurt in any way. She's fine. But it just goes to show you that traffic accidents are something that impact many, many people. And in fact, there are a lot of individuals that aren't quite so lucky. And so in the most recent report, over 30,000 fatalities were reported from traffic accidents. And in fact, from this report, they talk about how, you know, they list by the hour how many people die by the hour. And actually, at the end of my presentation, after we get done, four people will have passed away on average. So then here comes the autonomous car. The amazing potential that you know, we can monitor 360 degrees continuously. The car doesn't get tired, definitely doesn't get intoxicated. And so there's this question of, well, how well do autonomous cars need to drive before it can actually impact our lives, before it can actually, you know, save lives by avoiding things like human error and things? Well, these vehicles need to be able to operate in a lot of various challenging conditions. For example, the car may need to operate on ice or snow, where the friction isn't as high. These are scenarios where, you know, accidents can happen. Also, to avoid obstacles and things, the car will need to be able to make, you know, very quick maneuvers. And because the tires have a limited amount of force that they can generate to move the car, a lot of accidents happen when the car has exceeded the limits of handling. So let's take a look at just kind of a simple example of a car comes up to an obstacle. Now, it can, you know, in general do one of three things. It can see an obstacle and say, I'm going to stop, go to the left or the right. However, at higher speeds, stopping isn't an option. So just saying, oh, we're going to make an autonomous car where it's going to operate under all conditions, and if it sees an obstacle, all we have to do is just stop. Because eventually, if an obstacle comes in front of it that's close enough, that's a very bad strategy. Now, humans, a lot of times, these scenarios aren't typical scenarios. If you need to make an avoidance maneuver, for example, of an obstacle, and let's say that let's throw in hazardous weather as well. This is not something that an average driver is used to handling. In fact, they make a lot of mistakes. There's lots of rollover accidents that happen because folks will overcorrect on the freeway or on a highway trying to avoid an obstacle. But there are also human drivers that do a really good job of knowing where the limits are and handling right at the edge. And these are professional race car drivers. So the motivation that we had is, if we could program an autonomous car to handle the vehicle as well as a professional driver, then we're making that car safer. Because even in the most extreme circumstances, when an autonomous car enters a dangerous scenario, wouldn't it be nice to push pause on this scenario and have a professional driver steer you out of harm's way? So the particular emphasis that I'd like to talk about and what I've worked on with my PhD is path planning for an autonomous car. So I'd like to first talk about, you know, what's been done in the past, where are we coming from in terms of path planning, and then how can we describe a trajectory at the limits of handling just using a simple set of curves, and then generating and testing a trajectory at the limits of handling, so actually applying this scenario on a racetrack. And then finally, and this is actually my favorite part, is to actually demonstrate how we react to uncertain scenarios where there's uncertainty in friction and controller error. So let's first start on what's been done in the past. So let's lay out kind of the groundwork of path planning. planning, what it is, why we want, you know, paths, what are they for? So going from, let's say that we've chosen to, okay, change lanes. We've got this obstacle and we want to change lanes. Well, instead of just saying, okay, we need to change lanes, well, how do I specifically do that? Well, a path outlines a future trajectory of what the car needs to do. It gives it a specific, quantifiable objective. And so with, you know, with a path, we are able to plan what the car needs to do in the future. So some of the earlier problems that were solved in the robotics field is just saying, okay, how do we take an unstructured environment and represent it to where I'm trying to get from point A to point B? And so you can find a collection of waypoints that you can travel between, and you can prove, okay, based on this configuration of space, as long as I hit these waypoints, I can get from the start to the end. Okay, that's great, except that if you look at the curvature here, the curvature is infinite, which means if we're talking about a car, we're going to get to a waypoint and pivot the car and then, you know, keep going in a straight line. Well, that's not really possible. So then folks said, well, let's create simplified non-holonomic models, which means that my rear tires can't slide at very low speeds. So we'll have these paths where now they have finite curvature, and so kinematically they can follow it. The problem with that is that now you're assuming that as soon as you hit an arc, all of a sudden you're going to instantaneously turn your front tires. And again, especially when you get to faster and faster speeds, that's not possible. So, you know, we're essentially, you're seeing these constraints that we're piling on as we get to more realistic conditions or especially faster conditions. So they said, okay, how about we smooth the path now? Let's take this set of waypoints, and we're going to smooth the path to account for things like the slew rate of the tires, because there's a finite amount of rate that you can actually turn on tires. Well, what's unique about the research that I've done is, let's take a new constraint, which is the limits that the tires can generate for the car. So in other words, I don't have infinite force. When I'm going really fast and I need to move that car over or make some kind of dynamic maneuver, especially when the road conditions are quite poor, then this is an important constraint to take into consideration. Now, this isn't, in terms of this constraint, this isn't something new. There are folks that have done work in taking, you know, model predictive control or other types of detailed models, and then laying down point by point a racing line around the track. And what they've asked is, okay, we don't know what the path is, but let's set up an optimization where we can ask the optimization, well, what is the path? Now, what I'd like to show you is how we can take, so from this approach, the problem is that if something changes about the road, or if there's an obstacle that comes up, you have to rerun the optimization. And so there's kind of this question of, is there a simpler way where we can represent the path without relying on complex optimization that a lot of times takes quite a bit of time? So let's talk about how we can describe a trajectory at the limits using just a simple set of curves. So the inspiration of using just a simple set of curves came from Piero Truppi. And if you've heard Chris talk about this a few months ago, he also introduced Piero Truppi. Piero Truffi has a unique background of both his racing experiences as well as he earned a doctorate in industrial engineering. And we take two specific insights from his experience. First, he uses simple geometry to describe the racing line, and he plans the path between sets of straights. So in other words, if I think of a particular turn on the track, I am going to enter the turn at a particular position and orientation, and I'll exit at a particular position and orientation. And he also talks about how, at some point, you'll reach the tightest point of the turn, which we can represent as an arc. And then he talks about how it's very important to transition from the beginning and ending straights smoothly into the turn. And so we've chosen clothoids as as one of the members of our curve family to smoothly transition from a straight to an arc and back to a straight again. And as an example, this is a three-phase turn. So in other words, we're turning in, we're holding, and then we're turning out again. Now, I'd like to now kind of compare the difference between a skill driver's approach from what's been done in a lot of robotics, the robotics community. So when you plan a path, you have these waypoints that you've collected, and you said, okay, I'm gonna take these waypoints, I'm gonna connect them using polynomials or splines or something. Whereas skilled drivers say, no, I have a path that I need to follow, and I need to change lanes. Now, let's look at the implications of what it means when you use waypoints. If you take that path and you plot the curvature of that path, a lot of times there's overfitting in terms of saying, okay, if there's any wiggles at all in the path geometrically, the curvature of that path, those wiggles are amplified. So in other words, imagine driving a path, and the curvature is roughly what you would do with the steering wheel. If my curvature says I'm going to wiggle like this, then the steering wheel would actually wiggle based on the fact that just geometrically you have those artifacts in your path. Whereas if you're going to approach the limits and you want to drive with the limits, the curvature of your path needs to be smooth. Otherwise, you're not able to get out to the limits. So that's good that a professional driver gave us these insights in a book. But in terms of actually representing what professional drivers actually drive, can we take this simple set of curves and describe what they actually do on a racetrack? So we decided to take a skilled driver. This is David Vaden, the president of the racetrack at Thunderhill Raceway Park. It's about 3 hours north of here. And we put him into our instrumented car and recorded his racing line. And there's actually a lot of different turns, as you can see. So there's lots of turns kind of close together, as well as simple isolated turns. So there's a variety of different conditions that we're able to record and ask ourselves, okay, based on this recorded line, can we take that recorded line of just a discrete set of points, and can we fit our path structure of clothoid straights and arcs onto this to say we can describe a path at the limits using this curve structure? So we can take the curvature of the path that was recorded, and we can say, okay, let's look for the straights first. And so this is, if you look, this bound right here is where we find the straights, and this is what it looks like on the track. And so we set up all the turns between these pairs of straights. And we say, okay, now we need to shape each turn between these straights. And so we use, again, the curvature profile of the path. And so using sets of clothoids and arcs, we approximate the shape of each turn using clothoids and arcs. And using this simple curve structure, and actually I can get into kind of the gradient descent method that we use to improve the path and to get a really good fit. But the result of this is that we can represent a racing line that usually uses over 50,000 data points down to just 205 parameters. Or another way of saying this is that for a given segment, I'm good for 38 meters before I need new information. So to us, we're able to say, okay, based on this information and the fact that we're able to do this fit, you know, within 25 centimeters of the racing line, we're using a language that can describe what professional drivers actually drive on the track. Okay, so we're using a curve set that is good. And in fact, this is actually within the error of the repeatability of the skilled driver. So this is several laps of the skilled driver driving around the track. So how do we take this curve structure? Okay, we have this representation of the path. How do we relate it to the limits of handling? Because that's our whole objective, is we want to plan paths at the limits of handling. Well, because of the fact that we've based our curve structure on the curvature profile, we can take the curvature of the path very easily, and based on just a simple friction model, where this represents the maximum acceleration that a car can achieve at any given time. So either I can purely brake, or I can be at some lateral maximum lateral acceleration, or I can coordinate between the two. And so based on this model, we can actually calculate how fast a car should go as it brakes into a turn and accelerates out of the turn. So let's talk about how we actually generate and test a trajectory at the limits of handling. So using this same racetrack, we decided to make our own racing line. So in a similar way, we said, okay, we need to find the straights to structure the racing line. And so around we look for, just using the center line of the track,
we construct these straights along the racetrack to construct the racing line. And then we connect these straights with just simple three-phase turns, like I said earlier. There's a turn-in point, a point of maximum curvature, and then you exit onto the next straight. So all of these parameters that we use to describe the path, we can organize them into two basic categories. The parameters that control the shape of the turn, and the parameters that control the position of the straights. So when I make a change to the path, for example, I can move the straight over. I then reconnect the path, and then ensure that the path meets the inside apex of the track. And this is called hitting the apex. So this is an example of how, if I want to adjust the position of the straights, this is how I do it. I can also control the shape of each turn, and I can explore different ways of taking a turn. For example, this is just a symmetric turn that we have here, but I can say, okay, I actually want to see what an early apex is. So instead of hitting the apex here in the middle of the turn, race car drivers talk about early apexes and late apexes. So I can actually change the shape of the path and how you drive along that path based on the curvature of the path. So we can actually explore various racing strategies that professional drivers talk about using this simple curve structure. So for example, we can look at, for an isolated turn, we can look at early and late apexes, apex turns. And so, for example, if you turn in sooner, so this is the red line, you're actually able to travel through the turn faster, but then leave at a slower pace. And professional drivers talk about how, for an isolated turn, you want to take a late apex to leave the turn. And so we can actually simulate these results. So as you can see, the blue line at first is behind because it turns in later, but it's able to leave the turn at a faster velocity. Well, late apex turns isn't the only strategy. There's actually times when early apex makes sense. When you have two consecutive turns that are very close together, you can actually gain an advantage by turning in earlier for an early apex. So this is an example of how we can simulate, using just a simple curve structure and this friction circle model, how this particular strategy, we can validate what professional drivers talk about. So if we want to generate a racing line for the entire track, we can take the curvature of the entire path and all the parameters that I've talked about, and based on just a simple friction circle model, we can generate a velocity profile, or the desired velocity for the entire track, and then get a lap time. And so we can minimize the lap time based on this simple model. So how we do that is we adjust the straights, we translate them in pairs. So in other words, it makes sense to actually, if you're talking about entering a turn and leaving a turn, to adjust the position as well as the orientation of both, each and then one at a time. We also adjust the shape of the turn. This is kind of the examples that I talked about, early and late apex. Why don't we set this up and then find the best strategy based on the curvature of the path. And so what we do is we change a parameter, and then we readjust the path so that it hits the apex of the turn, and then we calculate and compare the lap time with the previous result, and iterate over that until we get our result. And so this is an example of how we compared what a skilled driver drove that we recorded to the synthesized line that we used for our approach. This is another example of how there's long straights, and there's actually two turns really close together. And there's this question of, well, you know, should the car stay inside, or should it loop outside? And actually, the results match up quite well with what the skilled driver drove as well. We've also talked about the curvature of the path, and how the curvature, the tightness of your turn, really limits how fast you can go. So in other words, if I'm going into a turn that's really tight, I can't go that fast because, again, the tires don't have enough force. And so based on the curvature, we can compare the curvature of the path with what a skilled driver drove. And again, there's some striking similarities. So let's actually apply this to our autonomous car. So this is Shelley, our autonomous race car. And And so what we've done is we've tapped into its electric power steering, active brake booster, and throttle by wire. And then we use GPS and the wheel speed sensors of the car to estimate the states of the car to see how both its position, acceleration, and how close to the limits we're getting. And let's take a quick look at a video of this.
And brakes. Okay, seeing is believing. Unfortunately, Chris seems to think that riding is believing. And he wants to put my life in the hands of Shelly's computer.
We're off.
Just like a big, expensive toy.
Okay, so you're not doing anything right now. This is not slowing down very much at the curb. No, we really don't have to.
We just went off the road, dude.
If you don't go up on the rimble strip, then you're slow. Any race car driver will tell you that.
What a smart little car.
Shelly is constantly adjusting her position on the track. Her adjustments just aren't very smooth. But I guess smooth doesn't matter. Your only priority is staying on the road.
You okay?
Oh my god.
Fortunately, this can take over at any time.
So when they were shooting that, we heard over the radio that he threw up, and we thought he threw up in the car. And all the graduate students were like, "Get him out of the car! He doesn't get to get back in the car at all." So fortunately, we were able to stop, and he was able to throw up outside the car. But we actually haven't had as many media requests after folks have seen that.
Was that dated?
Yes, it was. So from this is a plot of the acceleration of the car. And as we talked about with the friction circle model, we're using just a simple set of curves to follow a racing line. And then based on how we've measured the acceleration, you know, we're tracking our objective of what we're trying to accomplish here pretty well. But then comes the idea of, okay, if we want to go faster, we've got to push how much force we actually want to use from these tires. In other words, we want to make this friction circle as large as possible. The problem is that the larger you make it, the more you may run into trouble. And this is kind of where it gets to my favorite part of the research that I've done is the last part, which is we're going to demonstrate how to change the path and to compensate for uncertainty and friction when we push a little bit too hard. So in other words, if we don't know the road conditions perfectly, what happens when a car enters a turn too fast? Now, on the racetrack, what that means is we want a better lap time, so let's just up our you know, estimate of mu. Oh, there's a little bit more grip, there's a little bit more grip. But eventually, you'll overestimate how much grip you actually have on the track. Now, from a commercial standpoint, a car could hit an ice patch coming into a turn. There are scenarios where a car may slide off the road because the driver wasn't anticipating the conditions of the road. Well, first of all, we did an analysis on how sensitive this problem is. So this is a plot of, okay, if we hit the brakes as we're braking into the turn, and we've overestimated the amount of friction, so mu, just by 3%, we deviate from our desired velocity by, roughly, let's say, 2 meters per second, something like that. And you might think, well, what's 2 meters per second among friends? But in fact, that actually adds up to about 12 meters of tracking off your desired path. Now, here's what I mean. First of all, what does it mean to be on the limits? There's really, two fundamental ways that we can talk about it. One is, understeer, where your front tires can't generate any more force, and so it's not able to turn the car like you're asking it. The other one is if your rear tires saturate first, and that's when the rear end wants to become the front end. So let's take a look at kind of, when we're going to enter a turn, what we're planning on, what we're trying to do. So we're at the turn entrance, we step on the brakes, and then as we slowly begin to travel into the turn, we have to coordinate the brakes and steering to remain along the friction circle here, or maximum acceleration, until eventually we reach the tightest point of the turn where if we brake or accelerate, we'll actually begin to slide because all of the tires' forces are being used to generate the turn. So let's see what happens when we overestimate how much friction or grip we actually have. So the car enters the turn, and all of a sudden, it's not slowing down as much as it wanted to. But you know, the controller says, "Well, I need to track this path. This is my objective." So the tire, the steering continues to track that particular path. But again, speed is building up because more force is required laterally, and it doesn't have enough force longitudinally to slow down. Until eventually, you'll reach the point of reckoning where the car is no longer able to track that path. It is going faster than what it planned, and so the curvature of the path, the tightness of its turn is capped. And so at that point, it has to travel wider. It has to slide away from the path. All right, so this is kind of an animation to show just the general idea of what's happening. So what we decided to do is say, okay, isn't there a way where if we find ourselves above our desired velocity, so if we say, okay, here is the limits, this blue line is the limits, and so if you're above the blue line and these really are the physical limits, you're in trouble. So if you find yourself in this condition, how do we get back to something safe? Well, the solution that we found, that we've discovered, is why don't you just add a simple arc as you begin to turn? Why don't you add a simple arc? So what that means is, as I'm beginning to brake and turn in, what if I just stop steering for a minute, hold that, and then use the extra force that my tires to brake early in the turn? Geometrically, what that means is that I'm going to swing a little wider. So let's take a look at what that means. So we're heading into the turn. Uh-oh, we found ourselves, you know, with less friction than what we anticipated. Let's change the path. And by changing the path, we're actually changing the desired velocity that we want to track. And now we swing a little wider, and we are able to make the path that we planned. So this is an example of how we are taking a nominal path, and then we are reacting to something that we didn't anticipate. So how do you sense something like that? If you're going to go into a turn and you're going to say, oh, I'm going to sense when we've overestimated the friction, well, how do you do that? Well, the controller will brake as much as possible based on its estimation of friction. So if you've overestimated the friction, it will actually brake too much. And just like a car that doesn't have anti-lock brakes, if you slam on the brakes too hard, the tires will begin to lock up. That's where ABS comes in, is it senses the fact that there is a deviation between the tire speed and the car speed. When it senses this, you can actually measure the longitudinal slip of the car and say, wait a minute, I have stepped on the brakes too much. And so for our controller, based on our estimation of friction, when this happens, we can say, aha, my assumption of friction is different than reality. And so this is a signal that we use to change the path. I'm sorry?
What's the K?
Oh, that's the normalized longitudinal slip. So in other words, K max is your maximum amount of slip. So in other words, I've normalized this to -1 and 1. So in other words, if you were less than 1, then you're totally saturated. The tires are very much saturated. So we actually ran this out of this is actual data that we ran from the car. We actually didn't put the GoPros on this yet. This has yet to be done. But what we've done is this is data that we've taken from the car, and then I'm reanimating what happened. And so the blue car that you see is where we've actually modified the path. The red car is trying to track the original path. The area that we tested this on was actually pretty rough, and there was actually lots of like sand and junk on the road. So this is kind of demonstrating that if you're in kind of not very good road conditions, you know, and the only difference here is just replanning the path. And so the controller for the red car saturates its tires, but says, no, I'm gonna, you know, do my best. And eventually all four tires saturate. And if the controller wasn't wise enough to countersteer, the car would have actually spun out there. Whereas taking just a slightly wider path here, the car is able to remain in control and is actually able to leave the turn faster. So let's take a look at an example where we actually have a larger oval on a nice paved surface. Here we go. So when we operate at higher speeds, the results are even more pronounced. So again, the red car says, I have my original objective, which is this solid black line. And eventually, it just begins to plow out of the turn. And there's nothing that it can do. Whereas if you change the path, and by changing the path, what you're doing is you're saying, let me use more braking early. And then I will sacrifice that by geometrically swinging wider. And so by doing that, you're able to stay closer to your original objective. Now, the reason why I'm so excited about this particular part is that this is just one example of what is possible in terms of taking just a simple set of curves and reacting to uncertain conditions. You know, there's things that are done in our lab of obstacle avoidance, where if you encounter an obstacle, you can take this simple set of curves and avoid it. And so the main advantage here is that we're able to drive like a professional driver, and because we're using simple trajectories, we can calculate them very quickly. And those are the two advantages that we use in order to make cars safer. And that's my talk. Thank you very much.
So we have some wireless mics for questions. Please wait until I bring you the mic. Got one back here.
Hi, you said you, thank you for the discussion. Very good. You said you were using the braking sensor for longitudinal slippage.
Yes, that's right.
But what you care about here is latitudinal slippage. Is there enough correlation there that you can get that?
We can actually, in terms of actually deciding to change the path, we actually use the magnitude of the slip. And so you're absolutely right. We actually will take both the lateral slip and the longitudinal slip, so that the magnitude of both, to actually decide to change. However, when you're braking into the turn, usually your assumption of friction, usually you're able to detect that pretty quick along the straight.
Are you measuring latitudinal or lateral?
Yes.
So you're not just using what was built in for the...
Oh, absolutely, yes. So when I talk about the ABS and the slip and things like that, this is something the controller does. We actually turn the ABS and all of the other safety systems on the car off. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing our job because we're supposed to develop a safety system for the car.
Thank you.
You're doing the experiment on a track where you have very good knowledge of the geometry of the roadway. If you're going out into a public application where you might have to do a crash avoidance maneuver in a totally unexpected location, how do you deal with the uncertainty about the path you need to follow when you don't know the road geometry around you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say that where we've approached it is, first of all, can we do this? You know, how well are we operating at the limits? And so a lot of the discussion that we've talked about is things like, you know, measuring our performance of lap time versus a professional driver. However, you know, roads, in terms of their geometry, the actual, unless there's construction, the geometry of the road, you know, may not change very much. And so in terms of understanding its geometry, that's something that I imagine that you could probably know ahead of time. However, sensing what's there and what's not there, I think that's more a little bit more of a perception problem of knowing, okay, what's safe areas and what's not.
If there are some practical issues in terms of the inaccuracies in map databases that describe that, and also the uncertainties in the locations of the other vehicles that you're trying to avoid hitting.
You bet. And so I would say that the work that we've done, or that I've done for my PhD, is more of, given that information, if that information is accurate and you can rely on that, what do I do with it? How do I plan a path? And so that's where our research meets other folks and what they're doing.
Okay, three-part question, and then I'll come back for more.
So, part one, what's the lap time?
Okay.
Part two, you said friction circle as opposed to friction oval. What have your experience?
Great question.
And then part three, the measurement, direct measurement or infer measurement of the slip? How is that measured exactly?
Okay. All right, great. So remind me if I forget the parts, and then you may need to remind me. So the first part is our lap time. I think the last one that I recall was 2:21, and this is with a stock Audi with street tires, not with racing tires or anything else like that. So we're off from David Vaudin's by a few seconds. I think it's like 3 or 4 seconds. So we're close, but we're definitely making improvements in terms of how to race even better. The second part of your question, if I remember, was the slip that we measured. Oh, the friction circle, right. So in terms of the slides that you saw, it was a circle. However, on the car, it's actually not. For example, we account for longitudinal and lateral weight transfer. And so, you know, it's not a perfect circle, you're right. And so I guess that's it, if I understand that, or if I've answered that one okay. And then the third part was, we get that from a GPS INS suite in terms of measuring the velocity and side slip of the car and its yaw rate, and we compare that with the wheel speed sensors of the car.
I guess you're measuring also the individual wheel. I guess you're also measuring the individual wheel angle, turning
yes.
as well,
yes.
all four?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can get that from, you know, the front tires just from the steering system, and then the rear tires don't turn.
Taking into account first the alignment geometry of the suspension. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, how did your times in the beginning compare to the professional driver in the same car, and how is it now?
So it's I would say that it's improving with each time we make improvements. So first of all, I would say some of the main improvements that we were really looking at. Is once you get to the limits, you know, it's really that those are the limits. There is nothing that you can do more. And so, in terms of creating a feedback control structure where if you are on one side of the line where you're not at the limits, you can turn. Let's say that you're turning left. Turning left, if you're at the limits, turning left more doesn't do very much because you're at the limits already. Whereas turning right, if you're a little bit inside, is there the problem is kind of, you know, not a symmetric problem. And so one of the things that we've been working on to improve this is by taking the simple model that we use and then learning from how we track off the path each lap. So we'll enter a turn and we'll measure how far we're off the path. And then we'll actually learn from that, and then we'll actually feed that to the controller by saying you can adjust the steering angle by the error that you measured in the previous lap. So that's one way that we've used to improve lap times. The other one is this idea of changing the path. Because we're able to swing a little wider when we enter a turn too fast, we can now, you know, very carefully, you know, make the friction higher, and we have a strategy of recovering when the car enters a turn too quickly. So those are two ways that we've been using to really get aggressive and to track the racing line well.
Any questions from the right side? Okay, here we go.
Thanks for the talk. How fine-grained is your braking system in the sense that, you know, it's obviously not binary, but you're, you know, a race car driver's approach to braking can significantly vary and have a big influence on the dynamics in a turn?
That's a great question. So first of all, we are not able to control the brake bias. And so the friction circle that we use to define is based on the brake bias. So in other words, if I model my longitudinal weight transfer and I model the CG height, you know, really high, then essentially I'm saying that the front tires are going to have a lot more weight transfer than if it was lower. However, based on the brake bias, if the brake biases the braking to the rear tires a lot, then I'm actually probably going to lock up the rear tires. And this is something that we've noticed. So really what we have to do is we have to, what we've done in the past is you really have to just test, you know, where is the brake bias, and then adjust the height of the CG based on what the brake bias is. And I would also say that from your comment of what, you know, skilled drivers do, we've noticed that David Vaden will kind of roll on the brakes, you know, pretty gradually and kind of feel that out. That's something that we're looking to incorporate is how can you roll onto the brakes very gradually to not upset the balance of the car. So that's a great point.
One more question before Dean has another question, but since he was brave enough to sit on the front row, I think I'm going to let him do it. You go, Steve. You get one more too.
To do these experiments, you're using some pretty expensive instrumentation. What would the issues be in trying to put that on a car that's sold to the general public?
You bet. Yeah. So again, this is where we're taking kind of our work and our solution, saying, okay, a commercial solution would kind of hand those things to us. So, for example, a particular challenge that I imagine that you're alluding to is localization. How do you localize yourself? So, you know, something that folks do out there today in terms of public roads is you go out there and you pre-scan everything with a Velodyne, and then so essentially you pre-scan everything and then you match what you're reading the second time or the third time when you drive along the road, and you say, okay, based on when I recorded that path, where am I in relation to my previously recorded path? Whereas if you just use differential GPS, you can get to 3 centimeter accuracy. So I would say where we come in is that if you want to avoid an obstacle very quickly, then you know that obstacle is there. And so the maneuver would take, seconds? And so the drift from your location from then to when you've avoided the obstacle, you could probably use just the inertial sensors to give you a pretty good approximation. However, in the long haul, if you're talking about racing at the limits for seconds or even minutes, then you're going to need an expensive system to just tell you exactly where you are.
Okay, back on the path generation, mm-hmm. You're using the curvature chart. And that typically, is it correct that it's typically correlated almost proportional to lateral acceleration? And using straight line, that means that doesn't that imply your jerk, the first derivative of acceleration, now become discontinuous? What happens if you make the jerk continuous, hence the second order, instead of a straight line, but rather a curve to connect your curvature? Has that idea thought been?
So clothoids actually, they minimize the jerk of the path automatically. They have that built into them. Curvature of the path is the second derivative of the geometric path. So jerk is just one more derivative. So in other words, it's a finite value. So in other words, you may have, if you're talking about one up from jerk, I think that's pop or crackle, or I can't remember the next one up. But if you differentiate that again beyond jerk, then yes, then you're going to have an infinite amount. But essentially, the jerk will be finite at each part of the path. It may not be continuous, but it's finite, and it's actually constant because it's a clothoid. As opposed to wave, if there's wiggles in the path, now the jerk is where it kind of comes and gets you. And I imagine that's where you're getting the jerk problem. A lot of folks will do minimization over jerk, and if I'm not mistaken, what that's doing is you're trying to smooth out the path. You're trying to control jerk so that there's not spikes in the jerk, and then that translates to smoothing the path geometrically. If you use clothoids, a straight line is as small as jerk as you can get, by still changing the heading, if that makes sense. Sorry that I'm not, I need some plots and things to show you.
I'm gonna cut you off, Dean, because I'm sure you guys can continue the discussion. And Paul, if you can stay a little bit longer, people are welcome to come up. But first, the gift. We have a higher budget this year, so now the second sports car we're giving out for you, Paul. And we expect you to wear this on your first day at Ford. Is your new Nissan shirt. Thanks, Paul.